Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 5, Daisy Chats. My name is Alan, and I'm joined by Lil Gumshoe's trusty sidekick, Big Jerky Pants. It's Magellan.
Hey, what's up?
Just
my big pants over here.
Your large pants. Gum was the hardest word for me to find a parallel to there. What's the anti-gum?
Jerky's pretty good. I wouldn't have come to that. Sort of the same family of things in the checkout aisle. Jerky. I think you hit it on the head, man. I'm not gonna question you.
How's it going? You're back in the land of the living.
Yeah, school year's over, so I'm taking some time to chillax. And I am in Massachusetts, our home state, right now for about a week.
Yummy. It's delectable. Hip,
yeah. Super delectable.
It's very exciting, and I'm glad to have you here. I'm glad to have you here on this podcast, Daisy Chats, where we talk about pushing daisies. We are off to a new start with season 2, and this week we watched 2 episodes. We watched season 2, episode 1, Bzzz. And we also watched season 2, episode 2, Circus Circus. First, we're going to be discussing episode 1, which was written by Ryan Fuller, directed by Adam Kane, and it aired October 1st, 2008. Magellan, what happened in this episode?
The facts were these. Ned helps Chuck resurrect a bunch of bees. Emerson misses his daughter. Chuck decides to move out of Ned's apartment to live on her own next door. Olive hates hiding so many things from her friends, so Lily sends her to a nunnery where she learns that Chuck's dad was Vivian's fiancé. Meanwhile, in our A-plot of the week, Kentucky Fitz was the number one bee girl at Betty's Bees before being stung to death. Woolsey Nichols, a rival of Betty's, bought out her company and fell in love with Kentucky. However, after realizing that she was trying to sabotage the company with the help of Betty, he took his revenge and sent a swarm of bees to sting her to death. He confesses to the crime and is sent to jail.
Whew! This is an interesting episode to start off on, and it's a good A-plot to kick off the season with, because it's pushing daisies entirely on its shit. Like, visually, they are in a bee company factory, like, basically a Burt's Bees substitute. That means that there's plenty of outfits. There's tons of wordplay with bees and being and to be or not to be and all of these corny jokes. And I think the, like, Olive and the Chuck and Ned stuff is a really interesting place for them to take this season. What did you think of the whole situation?
With Chuck and Ned?
Well, yeah, with Chuck and Ned and with also Olive.
I think we can kind of take them piece by piece here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's start with Olive. I think in the first season, we talked about how it seems like Olive is kind of the main driver of B plots, really, throughout the show. In this case, this week, the A plot was a B plot.
You did it.
And the show's kind of leaning into that and being even more obvious about it. Like, not only are we sequestering Olive in this plot with these side characters, we're literally sequestering her with a bunch of nuns, which feels self-aware a little bit. And I appreciate that. I like the way that the nunnery looks. I like the fact that they wear, like, bright teal robes instead of black robes. I like the way that it's playing with Olive's character and actually moving her towards trying to get over things. This feels like forward momentum for her that's different than just her standing around and pining for Ned and talking to the ants and all that. So I like where Olive is going at this point in time. I don't know how long they can sustain this weird nunnery plot thing, but I'm into it for now.
Yeah, I think when we were reading summaries and it was like episode 2, Olive's still at the nunnery, that seemed really surprising, and I was like, well, I hope this isn't the season, you know, because this is our last, this is the last season of the show. But I agree, it's really direct character progression, and it's, again, visually very beautiful. Like, I think Brian Fuller and the visual creative staff on this show have a really distinct relationship with faith and spirituality, and like specifically through Christianity, wanting to portray it not as a bad thing necessarily, but just as an alien thing. Like, religion on a basic level is really weird, and really supernatural, and requires you to believe in a lot of strange things and take them as fact. And we get that humor from Mother Superior, who is Olive's the head nun of the nunnery. And, you know, she has all these things about, like, oh, we're going to begin mid-morning, mid-afternoon prayer. And, like, there's, like, 18,000 different prayers a day that they have to do. And they have all these rules and these things. And, like, that being the setting for Olive to sort of, like, pick apart what's going on in her head and figure out her feelings for Ned and her whole situation with the aunts and Chuck is really good. Like, I didn't expect spirituality and religion to be such a motivating factor in this season. But yeah, again, I don't think, like, the especially because Aunt Lily is there, there's only so far they can take Olive, like, hanging out at the nunnery, and she doesn't have her possessions anymore, and she wants them back, but she has to learn to sacrifice stuff. Like, eventually she's gonna learn that. She's gonna learn to be humble and then come back and hopefully have something figured out.
Yeah, for sure.
Loved seeing Lily there, though, but that's more in the second episode, where they have all the fun back and forth with the wine and the Bible and all that stuff, or the flask and the Bible. Whereas in this episode, I think the character relationship that I found the most interesting was Chuck and Ned. Sincerely believed that there wasn't a lot of room left for them to go with that. Like, they will. They love each other. It's great. We did it. And we got it in one. However, we did point out, and we even got, I remember getting emails about this. Last season, one of the weird things that rubbed us strangely with that whole situation was Chuck's lack of agency, and Chuck's, like, the fact that she's alive out of the desire of somebody who had a crush on her to see her again and to try to be with her again. And they just put their biggest foot forward, and they're like, you know what, she knows that too, and she never got to live a life of her own. She never got to live on her own. She never got to be independent. She never got to become an independent person. So she's stepping right on out. I think it works, the fact that they go outside from their apartments and it seems like they're about to go date other people, and then they run into each other and realize, oh, wait, no, you're my favorite. I love you. You're awesome.
Yeah. I enjoy the fact that the way that they're moving Ned and Chuck forward is by making them take a step back, because that gives us some space to build a little momentum in their relationship, because that's the problem, I think, with just thinking about pacing their relationship over the course of a season of television. As much as we're annoyed by will they, won't they stories, at the same time, if you just start it like they're together, then what can you build to? Whereas here, they're taking a step back from it, and they're letting Chuck explore what she needs to explore and resolve, so that she can come to their relationship with a newfound sense of self and a newfound sense of what she wants, that goes beyond, like, gratitude for being brought back to life.
Right.
And nostalgia for when they were kids, which are two nice things, but they're not good reasons to be in love with someone forever. So I think it's smart that the show is maneuvering and giving Chuck the space to more fully develop. I kind of didn't love the whole, like, they're next door neighbors and they come outside and pretend that they don't know each other, but they like each other right away. It was
cute. It's super cheesy.
It was cute and cheesy, but it also undermines what Chuck is doing to yeah. a certain degree, I think, because I don't know. I mean, I guess her goal isn't to like meet other dudes.
Her goal is to find out what she wants. It's to make goals for herself, if you will.
Right. But yeah, it just then feels like she's still working at the pie hole and they're still living next door to each other and they're like not that far flung. But I guess maybe it'll start moving that way. I don't know.
It's almost like a microcosm or like a small condensed version of a full relationship arc. Because the way this would work in another show or film is they're together for a while. They get complacent. I really liked that scene of them realize, like, of the complacency of their relationship where Ned is just, like, wearing jingle bells on his feet. And they know every time someone makes a noise, like, oh, don't walk near each other. Like, they're just so used to being in the same apartment and not touching each other that it's just become the way that they live. And it's, like, weird from the outside looking in. But they're like, yeah, this is what a Tuesday looks like, is I try to go to the bathroom. He comes here. I turn around. We know how it goes. And then to go from that complacency to we need to spend some time apart. And then literally one episode later being like, ah, but you know who's great is you. In another series, that would be like a year off. They would like literally like move hundreds of miles away, try things, maybe in a sadder show or something. She would like get into painting and meet some guy at work, and then it wouldn't go well. And then she'd come back and then they'd be like, oh, you know who I really love is you. And like that would be the cutesy romantic thing. So they're doing that without the distance. It's just like, tried it, didn't like it, liked you, works out for me. All right, cool.
Right. Yeah, I guess the problem is just that this show, so much of it is built around them having a fairy tale love for each other.
Yeah.
And any slight deviation from that totally unravels the tone of the show, like you were saying.
Right. I was speaking to a friend recently who was saying that they're less and less interested in watching the show with us now just because the show has gotten so comfortable with itself that it's getting a little bit, like, not pretentious, but, like, it's very satisfied with how smart it is and how comfortable it is. Like, all right, well, this is the way it works. Everything works out fine for us, huh? Isn't it awesome? Aren't we clever? Aren't these characters good? And they have good relationships with each other. Like, it is like almost a little bit too self-aware and trying too hard to just get there, that it doesn't do the legwork of like making you really think that that relationship struggled and came to this conclusion. And I think that's something interesting to think about going through the season. Like, is this show too complacent the way that they were? Is it too satisfied with having its romance work that it doesn't want to challenge that notion at all?
Right.
Because, like, last season when they were like, oh, maybe I want to be physical with other people, they ended that episode going, no, but really, not really. Like, they didn't actually go down that route that much. And, you know, I could see someone feeling like that is a bit of a cop-out. Like, the show isn't really exploring any of its ideas that thoroughly.
Yeah. Well, I think it's never really going to explore, like, they like different people, I guess.
Yeah, but I guess, it's not that kind of show.
Yeah, but I guess it is exploring the sort of things that you deal with when you're in, like, a long-term relationship of, like, oh, you know, one person wants to, like, pursue a job in a new field that's in a different city, and, like, what are you going to do about that? So in a microcosm, it's exploring what that's like, but it's also exploring it in a way that's like, well, they're not really moving that far away from each other, so
right, it's like really simulation, a simulacrum of that. Big word. There are, though, thematic ideas in this premiere that I think are really mature and well handled and fleshed out. So it's weird that the romance plot, the core relationship of the whole show, feels kind of weak because there is so much other strong stuff. I really liked Emerson in this pair of episodes. Emerson,
yeah,
following up on his finale new obsession with pop-up books, has created his own pop-up book series called Lil Gumshoe, which is about a little girl who solves crimes, and she's basically like a Black Harriet the Spy, just like solving crimes, and it's really cute. And the narrator makes it very clear that he is clearly projecting, like, Lil Gumshoe is trying to find her dad.
Right.
And he is, you know, like, the narrator literally says, like, his hope is that if this book gets out there and gets popular, that it's going to inspire his daughter to try and find him because he has run out of leads and he desperately wants to see her again.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that aspect of, like, Emerson is taking his hobbies and making something productive out of them. And then also, like, he's talking and thinking about what being a parent is. Yeah. And I didn't know that that was what I wanted out of Emerson, but that's sort of the angle they're taking. And I'm into it too.
Yeah. It gives him, it fleshes out his character, right? Because we knew that there was something under the gruffness that was tender and sweet, but now we know specifically what that is. And it also gives us a plot that we're building, and we're building his character gradually, but then we get to see this pay off in an episode. So now we have more things to look forward to than just like, oh, Ned and Chuck will get to touch each other. We have that, and now we have, oh, Chuck's going to find out that Lily's her mom, and we have Emerson's going to find his daughter. Like, we're gearing up to have a pretty big back half of the season.
Yeah, this season seems to be about people realizing, oh shit, I have a problem that needs to be fixed, or I need to learn something now, and making the steps to do that. Like Chuck looking for independence, and Olive looking for peace of mind, and Emerson looking for his daughter, and Aunt Lily looking for closure. Like, people are looking for things and making the steps to find them, and I think that's what you want. That's what you want out of any dramatic TV show, is mm-hmm. to see people work hard and change as a result. I felt sort of mixed on the whole bees plot line. The murder of Kentucky Fitz and the investigation into her whole company. It's really beautiful. This and the nunnery are like the best sets so far. Like, the whole bee factory, with all the office buildings, and then the nunnery being all the teal nuns, is like good, beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. The show's just immediately on its shit. Like, oh, we got a murder this week. Oh, it's in a bee factory. Fantastic. Well, here we go. Or like a honey factory. Let's get a bunch of people wearing primary yellows and talking and making bee puns. Like, that's just everything. That's Pushing Daisies in a nutshell. This show's second episode was about eco-friendly sunflower cars. So it's just it just feels like, all right, well, business as usual. We're at it again. I think one thing I really liked about this plotline, though, was its focus on women, and its lens taking a lens to like aging and aging out of celebrity and business, and how women are when working together can get a lot done, and it's not just about like overthrowing a corporation like a lot of season one was. It's just like, no, like when we get over corporate buyouts and all this stuff and we have a goal in mind, we can we can run a company. It doesn't have to be like the women don't have to be relegated to damsels or murder victims. Like, they're one of them is a straight up a CEO who does like a hostile takeover and all this stuff. Did you like this whole B plot line?
I, like you, really loved the set design and the costume design. Mm-hmm. And like the prop work too. I love that sign of like who the main bee girl is with the overlay that he keeps flipping over of
Kentucky. Oh my god, that was good.
Like,
yeah.
Just this little pieces of craftsmanship that are going into this show, and like the photograph of the girl with the beard of bees, like all these little details that are really well designed. In terms of the mystery of it, I wasn't like all that bought into it. It was a little convoluted, I think, to follow, because it's like he bought the company, so they're trying to sabotage it together, but is she jealous that she's being replaced or she's not? I don't know. It worked, and I think I could make sense of it, but I just didn't find myself really invested in it that much. I liked French Stewart. He was fun.
God, French Stewart's the best. I love French
Stewart. He's the right kind of actor to bring into one of these cameo roles in this show. because he's just weird and you recognize him, but then you get over it pretty quickly.
Yeah, you're like, all right, well, you don't spend the whole time going, hey, that's French Stewart, because he's not, like, it's Third Rock from the Sun guy. What else do you know him from off the top of your head?
Right.
He's just a face, yeah.
There was some stuff in this plot, though, that was like, ah!
Yeah, it's like Brian Fuller shit.
When they found her in the morgue, covered in
all the bee stings. Amazing bee sting prosthetic work. Way great. Creepier though when super she creepy. When she it's super creepy, super yucky, kind of like realistic in a way that like I've seen bee stings look like that when they get really like old. But then when the guy, the mortician, who we also, I guess maybe this isn't a reveal, but they make it abundantly clear that he knows what they're doing, and that Emerson pays him off to not talk about it. Because he says, like, it's not like you're going to talk to her. And then Emerson's like, yeah, it's not like I'm going to talk to her, and hands him a wad of money. Again, I really just like that mortician. I think he's good. And then he says, like, don't flip her over. And after they re-kill her, they hear a rumbling inside. And then a million bees pour out of her mouth.
Yep, that was too much.
It's too much. It sucks. It's so creepy and yucky. Like, bees in by themselves are not scary. They're annoying, but they're important to the environment, and we need to protect the bees. A million bees? No thanks, I'm good. Like, a million bees inside of someone's mouth? I'm super good. That borders on, like, remember that episode of Escape Chats where it was a Clockwork Nabari, and they had like the eye torture device, and you were like, yep, they found the thing I can't watch.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, stuff coming out of people's mouths is where I draw the line.
You don't love that.
Yeah, it might be hard for me, my future dental career, but...
right.
Other creepy bee stuff. The bad guy being covered in... like, using bees as a disguise, yeah, is like really fucked.
Spitting a bee into your mouth so that the bees attack you.
So it's like a bee capsule or something? Like, what is that? Yeah. Why does that device do that?
It's... arbitrary. It like has their queen inside or something.
Oh, that makes sense. So okay, like
want to protect the queen, I guess.
And Chuck screams so the capsule goes into her mouth and then the bees attack her.
Yeah, but she like doesn't move, so they don't think that she's a threat.
Right. It's yeah, really it's dark. Really... it's not even dark. It's just like like, because the CG is not bad on the bees. Yeah, it's like fine. It's clearly CG, but it 100% gets the point across. Like,
the
thing with CG is you can tell it's bad because it has a mismatch with what you expect reality to look like. Nobody has ever seen a million bees on somebody's body, so it like I can't compare this to real life. It looks real enough, of course, because it looks like bees. But it's all really yucky, and then they get the bees away from her, and they go outside and. Turns out it's French Stewart. And then, like I said I wrote in the summary, like, he confesses. This is kind of similar to, like, two episodes ago where it was the crime with the real doll. And the guy's just like, yeah, I did it. Like, yeah, you found out.
Yeah.
Which brings up a brief question I wanted to ask you. So the show has been doing this since the beginning, but I haven't really thought about it until now. When the narrator towards the end of the episode goes like the facts were these and then reveals like everything that happened in the case, is that so like the how it's kind of hard to frame my question. The characters in the show are learning that because of who they're interrogating, but we are learning that instead of seeing that interrogation, we're just getting it as flashbacks. It's a weird narrative device. It kind of feels like they're skipping the part where they solve the crime to me sometimes. But I guess the idea is they get there, like literally get to the guy's face and they're like, hey, what did you do? And then he tells them and we're just not seeing that scene. We're seeing it as a flashback.
Yeah, basically. Basically, yeah.
But for me in this moment, I was like, wait, I feel like we're not getting, there's something, maybe there's like some payoff of having the guy say it that would have been that's what I'm looking for, but it's not a big deal. It's just like something I was thinking about. Yeah, and then, I mean, the guy confesses, and then they catch him. And then a bunch of stuff happens at the end of the episode, like real rapid fire. We learn about the whole Lil Gumshoe thing. Olive at the nunnery has a friend who she calls Pigby, which is super cute. I love baby pigs a lot. I think he's mm-hmm. cute as hell. Not really a baby, just like an adult pig that just hangs out and listens to her.
Yeah.
A big pig. Hey, a big pig. And then also Ned's dad is alive.
Yeah, they just kind of threw that in at the end, just for fun.
Here's a season plot. Okay, that's a big deal that we're going to have to deal with soon.
Mm-hmm. Not really that interested in that, but okay.
Yeah. And then I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's actually it.
Nice.
We learned that the nunnery is where Lily had Chuck. That's not really a big reveal. It's framed as a reveal. I feel like the Lily stuff is being doled out really slowly and in a way that's a little bit too confusing for the viewer, and they should just like they should frame that differently. I don't know. I'm a little bit torn on how her backstory with Chuck's parentage is being revealed. Cause there's that scene in the second episode where they're in the church and she's like, he's the guy, Mr. Chuck is not the dad, but he is, but I did have sex with him, but I didn't have sex, but like blah blah. We never slept together. And I think she's just lying in that moment, but it's really confusing. I digress. Mr. Majan, did you have any stray notes about Buzz?
I just like Aunt Lily's teal eye patch.
Yeah.
And I like the scene where Olive's stuff gets given away to the poor people. It was a little questionable, but I thought it was funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, hey, Olive sucks. Has a lot of stuff about her that sucks. She's very possessive and a bit snobby. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm going to file a police report against these poor people. Actually, that's probably bad. That's probably not going to go well for them. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be about her like doing it's that classic plot where she's like, no, this is stupid. I don't want to learn to give up worldly possessions. And then she totally is going to be good. She's going to get good at that. It's going to work. I believe in Olive. Also, the Sound of Music shot was kind of weird. That was their cut to the nunnery. Was Olive in a green field being like, la, la, la. And then the nuns are like, shh. And she realizes that she's been shushed for the first time in her life. And then when she has the outburst at the pie hole and she's like, I've got a shotgun of truth and I got bullets pointed in every direction. Yeah, blah, blah. Fantastic work from Kristen Chenoweth. Mm-hmm. Just commands that. It's like seven people in that. Every member of the cast is in that scene and she commands all the attention. It's very good.
Yeah, she's awesome.
And then, yeah, I wrote a lot about French Stewart because I freaking love his very distinct face, his weird smile. He's just a cool guy.
Mm-hmm.
That, Mr. Friendo, is what I have for this episode. Sorry, I'm a little hick burpy right now. That's no good.
It's all right, man.
It's okay. Yeah, you're good. Oh, it's all right. Let me real quickly see if we have any trivia for the episode. Oh, this is the first episode, and so far only one, where Young Chuck and the coroner were listed as guest stars. Both were previously co-stars. That's interesting. I guess maybe the coroner is going to become more important.
Wait, he was listed as a guest star?
Yeah.
Isn't co-star like better than guest star?
Previously listed as co-stars. Oh, after this episode, Richardson was back to being listed as a co-star. Oh, so that's just a one-off thing for him.
Oh, that's weird.
And then Ned mentions waiting for the Betty Bees company to call Happy Times temp agency. Oh, that's when he like steals the guy's job. That's a Dead Like Me reference. That's all that is. Happy Times temp agency is the temp agency from, I believe that's also that's another Brian Fuller show. Cool. He's doing little crossovers.
Yeah.
I can't wait to have enough work in my backlog that I can cross reference things. That's like goals, and totally achievable goals, not even like unreasonable. That's what we got for this episode. We didn't get any feedback this week. Our release schedule has been readjusting, so that's understandable. Do send in your feedback to chatspot@gmail.com or at chatspot on Twitter if you'd like to have us talk about your feedback on this segment, in this segment. But for now, we're going to take a little musical break, and we'll be right back to discuss Circus Circus.
Welcome back to Daisy Chats. The second episode we watched this week was Season 2, Episode 2 of Pushing Daisies, Circus Circus, written by Peter Ocko and directed by Lawrence Trilling. It aired on October 8th, 2008. Alan, what happened in Circus Circus?
Well, Magellan, the facts were these. Business is going great for Emerson when he's approached by George Ann Heaps, who wants to hire him to find her missing daughter, Nikki. Chuck learns from Nikki's friend Randy Jean that Nikki ran off to be famous and left with her boyfriend Rocky. They find Rocky, a mime, dead in his van. When they resurrect and interrogate him, he reveals that Nikki left him to be with a clown. At the circus, an acrobat named Pierre tells him to speak to the ringmaster, whose secretary, Miss DeJong, spills the beans by accident. This leads to a cold trail of dead clowns, but no Nikki. Returning to the ringmaster, after a lead from one Broyce von Dienis, the gang learns that the murdered clowns were trying to form a workers' union, so he was planning to fire all of them. He sent Nikki to spy on one of their workers' meetings, but Pierre the acrobat found out and set about shutting their union down for good. Once he realized that Nikki knew about his plan, he planned on killing her too, but the gang catches up to Pierre, and at the last second, he's kidnapped Nikki. Chuck reads Rocky's last poem to them, and Ned uses the opportunity to throw a rock at Pierre, knocking him out and saving Nikki. Olive continues her nunnery adventures with Aunt Lily this episode, Chuck has to avoid seeing Aunt Vivian, and Ned and Chuck attempt to kickstart their relationship by introducing themselves to each other like it's the very first time. It's a fun one.
Yeah, I enjoyed this episode.
Would you say you enjoyed it more or less than Bzzz?
I think I liked it a little more.
Okay.
I appreciate it. There was a lot of creative visual comedy in this episode that hasn't really been present to the same degree in previous ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like some gags, like when Ned is about to go into the trailer, like walk back into the trailer to interrogate that woman, but he has to wait for the cannon to roll by.
Yeah,
and then when he comes back out, he's about to swear and there's like somebody breathes fire in front of the screen. Or when they find the clowns dead and they keep bringing the bodies out of the clown car. Just like little things like that. I appreciate it. I had more fun, I think, with this mystery than I did with the one in Bzzz. Because I really liked, like we were talking about the set design and the costume design.
Yeah.
But it skeeved me out and I wasn't super engaged. But with this one, the A plot grabbed me a little bit more.
Right, it's very. I think it's just really efficient, and I like. I don't know. I like a circus setting, in general, but especially as a murder mystery plot. It gives us a lot of room for wacky characters without having them, like that's just their job is to be characters. So it instead of having like a regular person, but they're weird, it's just like, no, this is this person's job is like they are a bearded man or they are, you know, Pierre the acrobat comes into frame from above and comes downward and that's funny and he has a funny accent and like that's the goof.
Yeah.
The thing you mentioned though about the clowns, I think that is my favorite type of humor in this show, which is like kind it's definitely dark, but it's not bleak.
Right.
You're like, oof, yeah, that's dead. That's dead bodies. But also, it's super funny watching a bunch of clowns fall out of a car. Mm-hmm. Because it's borderline like cartoonish because that's, you know, what they do in cartoons when there's a bunch of clowns coming out of a car as they all walk out and it's funny. I think that the plot just moved really well. I thought it was paced extremely well. And mm-hmm. I didn't find myself bored for a second of this one.
Yeah, I agree.
If I have anything that disappointed me, I would just say, like, we were talking about this earlier, but the Ned and Chuck stuff feels like stakes-free romance building.
Yeah.
But it's fine. Like, we're not here to watch them struggle and fight. I think we talked about this, but, like, I would have liked to see them actually engage with that fear of, like, what happens when we separate from each other. Like, what changes about our relationship when we don't live together anymore?
Yeah, and maybe they'll get into that more as the season goes on, because they're so newly separated from each other. I don't know. It just, like, we just know that they're going to be together, so there's no like tension there. But it's fine. I don't need the show to like convince me that they have a huge problems in their relationship.
Right.
I don't really know what I need. I don't know. I think the show is still trying to figure out, like, what is this about? What is this world all about? And they're moving us towards other character plots that will take up more space and time than the, like, Chuck and Ned thing. So, like, this episode is doing a lot to set up and lay the groundwork for Emerson's plot with his daughter.
Yeah.
And, like, kind of giving him an emotional foundation of oh, it turns out that she was, like, taken away from him by the mom. Like, it wasn't like he abandoned her or whatever.
But he still feels regret about it.
He's, like, regretful, and he wants her to find him. And for some reason, like, he can't find her. I don't know.
There's layers to that one that I'm really interested in. It's one of those where I'm like, I honestly hope it works out for him, because I want to see... I think I just want to see Emerson have a good day. Like, this is a character who's been broken by the world in a lot of ways and is very cynical, at least compared to Ned and Chuck, especially compared to Chuck. But I want things to work out for him. I don't know why. I just find myself very invested in, like, his improvement.
I agree.
And I think that reflects how good not only Shy McBride's performance is, but, like, just the writing on that. Like, it's a missing daughter plot that doesn't feel rote or boring.
Yeah.
Because, like, this show definitely intentionally borrows a lot of ideas and plot points and concepts from, you know, other television of this genre and noir fiction and detective fiction, mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. So, but it manages to do all that and still be really light. And so when I see a character like Emerson, who would fit super well in, like, a crunchy noir story from, like, the 50s if he was white. But I just want to... I don't know. I find him... his whole quest for his daughter to be really engaging so far.
Yeah, I agree.
Speaking
it's
of, like, the...
It's sort of a slam dunk.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
It's kind of a slam dunk to, like, set up a character who you think is going to be this one-dimensional curmudgeon and then give him a secret daughter. It's bound to be engaging. Anyway, what were you saying?
Bound to be engaging is what I was going to say.
Uh-huh, honey.
Well, I was going to say there's more like stuff ripped out of cartoons or like slapstick comedy in this episode than usual, I think. Like whenever Aunt Vivian comes to the pie hole or comes within range of Chuck, she like does a perfect prat jump over like the counter. They had to use a stunt double for that. There's no way that the actress just did that, because that's like a very unsafe stunt to do a lot.
Sure.
But it's very funny to me. And God, there was so... I have like a bunch of examples. Like the acrobat coming from above screen and like smoking a cigarette upside down. Even just like when they're in the church and it's Olive and Aunt Lily. Aunt Lily has a flask in her Bible, which like isn't a thing you see in real life, but is a thing I've seen in cartoons.
Right.
So it's just like, this is so... The show is like leaning into its cartooniness more and more, and I really like that.
That was fun about this episode. On the topic of the nunnery stuff, you want to just talk about that?
Definitely.
What did you think of the new revelations around Aunt Lily? How the husband, how it was Vivian's fiance, is that right?
I was going to ask to confirm, because I feel, well, I got it mixed up between this episode and the last one. I'm like, which thing happened in which one? But
I think we didn't discuss it if it happened in the last one. The revelation essentially being that Chuck's father was Aunt Vivian's fiance,
Right.
And Aunt
not
Lily,
only that, Aunt Lily is
Aunt Lily, you're good. Aunt Lily is Chuck's mom, and the dad was Vivian's fiance. So there's some intrigue there. What do you think of that development?
I think what works best about it is that Aunt Lily is like not addressing it yet, even though she's being asked specifically about it. They have that scene that I referenced last segment about when they're in the church and Olive is like, hey, here's what I think happened, and like picks up on the lie in Aunt Lily's story and goes like, wait a minute, how did you have a child with a man who was engaged to your sister? And she like dodges the question and doesn't answer it and like makes a joke about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, that's very believable, like being interrogated about something fundamental about your past, because she's sober at this point. The only reason she told Olive the first time was because she was like overdosed on the mood stabilizers.
Yeah.
So I think like in her default state, Aunt Lily is that type of person who deflects a lot.
Yes.
And what works about that is like, I don't want all of that to be revealed right now. I think that's something that is, that works better as a drip feed of information as opposed to
like
a dump.
I think we have the information. I don't think there's any more information.
You don't think there's anything left? Yeah.
I don't think so. I think now it's just a matter of waiting for Chuck to find out and for Vivian to find out.
Right. And what are they going to do about that? Like, what's the consequence of that?
Right. When it was revealed that it was Vivian's fiance, I sort of had two reactions to that. On the one hand, it made sense to me because when we found out that Lily was Chuck's mom, I didn't really understand why Vivian wouldn't know that, you know?
Right. Yeah, they're
like
sisters.
Why would Lily have kept that a secret? But now, knowing that it was Vivian's fiance, now my question is, why did it fall to them to take care of Chuck? Like, why does that make sense? If Vivian's assumption was just like, this is just a daughter that he had with some person that he cheated on me with, why after all those years of Chuck being alive would they be the ones who were expected to take care of her?
That's a good question, actually.
It doesn't really make sense.
I think that is the kind of thing that they can answer in future episodes, though.
Yeah.
Because what needs to happen is Vivian needs to find out.
Right.
For us to get to the conclusion.
To get the full answer.
Yes, exactly.
Sure.
So I kind of hope that happens just because I want to know more about that. Like, I want to just like make sense of that and put it to bed in like a comfortable way.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think this show is about, in a lot of ways, it's not only, we talk a lot in the first season about how, you know, it's about love and relationships. And it is constantly stretching the definition of relationships and of love. Mm-hmm. You know, we had some problems with the limited scope of romantic love in the first season, but familial love and like faith and love of faith and love of feeling like part of community and love as a parent and love as an aunt and love as a guardian. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff is getting addressed in this season already, even just in this episode and in the stuff we're talking about. And I am really happy that we are expanding our definitions again, even further of love and these types of relationships.
Yeah, sure. I agree.
Because you can only do so much with a show about like romantic and sexual love. You know, there are like shows mm-hmm. about couples and shows about dating and stuff like that. But at some point, they often have to get into I think one of my problems, I don't mean to get like too broad with this conversation topic, but one of my problems with modern like romance and romantic comedies is that they almost never avoid the breaking the fourth wall and addressing the fact that these are two people in love and who know what it's like to be young and in love in the modern day. Like, Before Sunrise is a movie where people are in love and they know it's weird falling in love with someone from a different country, but it's also, there's something poetic about it.
Sure.
And
I mean, that movie is an especially self-aware film.
Right.
You're saying that movies are not self-aware enough?
Well, no, I'm saying these days, including that film, they're too self-aware.
Okay.
That's basically what I'm getting at. And I think, I think you have to, like, I've been reading this essay by David Foster Wallace about television and the death of irony. And one of the like recurring points is like, by constantly referring to the thing that you're talking about in that ironic, like detached fourth person way, you are robbing it of any chance to make people feel anything. And, you know, in his opinion, in his like very cynical 90s brain, that was like the death of storytelling. Was when people discovered irony and learned how to market and center stories around irony.
Because people can't take it seriously anymore, you're saying?
Yeah, because it can't land in the way that it's supposed to if people are constantly being like, oh, I feel like I'm in a wacky sitcom or I'm in a wacky romance. Like, this is crazy. This isn't how couples fall in love. As soon as you're saying stuff like that, you are pulling yourself back from reality and looking at your own relationship. And like couples do that in real life. I get that, but.
Well, so where do you think Pushing Daisies falls into that then?
I think that's what I was going to get at is like, I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
I think at least with Chuck and Ned, it's surprisingly unironic.
To an extent, although the entire frame of the show is that it's a storybook. Like, the show is exceedingly aware of itself and what it's doing.
Yeah. The fact that it has a narrator is the key point in that.
But it doesn't seem like it's making fun of it. Like, it's going over the top so that we can take it seriously, I guess.
Right. But having Ned and Chuck fall in love again in the course of, like, 5 minutes in a scene is, like, it's almost, like, too self-aware. It's like, all right, well, we just did that. It doesn't feel... Right. It ends up detaching it from reality. Sometimes, which is something I occasionally have a problem with the show.
Right.
I also, briefly wanted to talk about the, it's not dwelled on much, but the villain of this episode being Pierre the Acrobat, also being the ringmaster guy, because they're anti-union. Like, the ringmaster guy is, like, understandably anti-union, I guess, because... You know, his workers are going to ask for more pay from him.
Sure, because he's the boss, yeah.
Because he's the boss, and it makes sense for the boss to be the bad guy. But Pierre is just, like, the European dude who also works here. Like, he's detached enough by how he acts and his line of work, but he's still just another employee, and the fact that he hates it is very interesting. It's just like, oh, there's a worker who hates unions.
There's right, a guy because he wouldn't have been in the union. It was a clown's union, yeah.
It was a clown's unit, so he dislikes it, and he's mad about it because he's not in it, but not because it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Which I just think is really interesting. Like, the show is not making a joke about unions or saying that they're bad. If anything, it's saying that they're a good idea and that it's unfortunate that, you know, they often can't service everyone or it's really hard to get employers to stand by a union.
Yeah, they're taking an angle on it that is somewhat surprising. Because it does seem to make sense that, like, of course the boss would be trying to sabotage them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's just a guy who wants to sabotage them also and, like, murder the person who is working and all this stuff. It's something.
Yeah.
I found that all really, really weird and cool. Like, the show can talk about that stuff and address it and not make it, like, the center of the episode. It's just a thing that happens.
Yeah. Well, and we've had a few episodes that have been, like, about business intrigue.
Workers' rights, yeah.
Yeah, like, the past episode was about business intrigue, but that was about, like, a hostile takeover and, like, intentional sabotage. It was a different angle. And this is about unionization. They really are taking the time to make sure that plots are, like, as different and far flung from each other as possible, not just in terms of the set dressing or the elements of them, but also in terms of the actual spine of the plot.
Right. It's villains and their motivations are smart and interesting and relevant to the modern day. And I actually think that not only is a good thing about this show, but it's just reflected in the fiction that it's borrowing ideas from. Like, noir and detective fiction is also about like land grabs and like capitalism and money right. hoarders and all that stuff.
Right.
Chinatown, with all my problems with that movie, is about like land distribution and like water,
rights to water access. Yeah,
water access, exactly. In a specific time, in a specific place.
What problems do you have with Chinatown?
I mean, I think it's paced really slowly, and it's not that much fun on a rewatch. And some part of it, towards the end, I found it was a little bit too self-aware again.
Hmm. Well, it is. I mean, it is. It's like a deconstruction of noir.
Right. Well, I haven't seen Chinatown in like 10 years, to be fair. So.
Oh, okay.
Be that as it will. I kind of want to rewatch more. This series is making me want to watch more detective fiction, though, or read some more.
Yeah, just to see how they kind of take the tropes and then
do fun stuff with it a little bit. Right. Because I've definitely read a lot about it, but seen a decent amount of that stuff, but I haven't. There's still I have a lot of blank spaces.
Yeah.
Have you seen Casablanca?
Yes.
You saw it a long time ago, right?
A few years ago. Mm. To be honest, it did not stick with me at all. I just remember that there are flashbacks in it or something, and there's a part where it's his club and stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's all I got.
I just asked because that one, from what I understand about it, from what little I know culturally about it, is another intersection of romance and crime, and mm-hmm. Crime related to politics and economy.
Right.
But I haven't seen that one. We should watch what's Rosebud? Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yeah. That classic crime film.
I've always wanted to. Well, I know. Well, it's like a mystery, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't watch enough old films. That was my last note here. I think the other thing I was going to say about Emerson was the best stuff we get out of him this episode is not only him talking about his daughter, but it's him working hard for this woman and getting that emotional response to her wanting to find her daughter because he just sees himself in that family.
Uh-huh.
Like in the end when they're reunited and they don't like each other and he's like, you need to make it work. Like you need to learn to compromise and does not let them leave until they hug it out, basically.
Yeah, it gives you an appreciation for why Emerson is a private investigator. And it makes it feel like it's not just some arbitrary thing that we want to tell a detective story. We needed a PI. So that's him. No, he has a reason. His daughter was separated from him. And now he's just trying to give people closure the way that he doesn't have it, you know?
Right. That's all he wants out of his daughter situation is closure.
Yeah, I really appreciate that this show puts so much time and effort into making sure that we understand why people are the way that they are or why they are the people they are. Ned, and I think this episode even started with a sort of reminder that Ned is a pie maker because his mom made pies. That may have been the first one, but it's it's not just a random thing because it's cute. It's meant to kind of capture his desire for a home and for stability and for reminders.
Making something out of nothing, right?
Yeah, reminders of a past he didn't have and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's not something the show necessarily has to do, but it makes me much more invested in everyone.
Yeah.
Is knowing where they're coming from. Like even the villains, Chuck and Ned and Olive and Emerson always get, and the aunts, get all this motivation and stuff, but also there pretty much never goes by a villain who we don't learn something about and learn why they are the way they are. Because villains are people too. They are terrible and they usually need to go to jail, but it doesn't stop them from being full characters.
Right. Right.
I think that's something that makes this show more fun than your standard Law and Order is. Law and Order is often about once we found the what the crime and the motive was, we don't care about the why. I feel like it's oh, they're looking for answers. They're not looking for understanding the person.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because that's just the thing with TV these days is that often people just want the answer.
And that's why, like, you know, spoiler culture and all that stuff, and like a lot of modern TV is centered around like mysteries and things that need to be solved, unfortunately, is just because that's the thing that people want these days. But Pushing Daisies offers a world where it's like, no, this is the way people live. They're bad and we're going to stop them, but like, we're not casting judgment on them that harshly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's what I got for Circus. It's a very tight episode. It's a fun one. There's not too much that we didn't talk about, though. So I think that's what I got. Yeah. Did you have any stray notes?
I just like the idea of someone named Bryce Von Dinas and then making a limerick out of his name.
He has a big...
Yeah, I thought that was fun.
Yeah, and then him coming to the pie hole and being like, so I got 50 free pies? And they're like, yeah, here's your pies. Congratulations. Yeah, I was going to bring that guy up because he was fun. I have a little bit of trivia about this episode. The scene of Lily talking to Olive in the nunnery is from Pigeon, but the blue screen background was changed in this recap.
Mm-hmm.
Olive tells Lily her deep, dark secret that she's in love with Ned. However, Lily already knew that, as in Buzz, she told Olive, praying that the man you worship will show you some sign of his love. You can do that here. So the joke is that everyone knows Olive likes Ned. I don't think it's like,
yeah,
like the stuff with Lily and Chuck is actually a big secret that mm-hmm. only Olive right now knows. But like, everyone knows that Olive likes Ned. I think,
yes, she thinks that she's like keeping that so secret.
Yeah. I think the only person who doesn't know that she likes Ned is Ned.
Right.
Which is unfortunate. Or maybe he does, because, you know, but the whole, like, kiss thing.
Right.
So, but that's, like, the sort of fun joke. What else is in here? This recap uses a different take of Olive saying, I'm quitting you. That's interesting. And in the credits, the character of Rocky Baselli is incorrectly listed as Rocky Milano. Production notes. I love it. My guys.
Yeah.
That is going to do it for our discussion of these two episodes of Pushing Daisies. John, what are we going to be watching next week on Daisy Chats?
Next week, as always, we are watching two episodes of Pushing Daisies. The first is Season 2, Episode 3, Bad Habits. Olive calls on the pie maker and Emerson to solve a suspicious suicide of a fellow nun that she believes was murdered. Meanwhile, Chuck tries to fill in her family tree and considers what to do in the present with her new lease on life. The second episode is Season 2, Episode 4, Frescorts. I think that's how you say it. When the most popular escort at a rent-a-friend agency turns up dead, the team investigates who killed him, including likely suspect Randy Mann, played by David Arquette, the guy's antisocial taxidermy-loving roommate. Meanwhile, Emerson's famed private investigator mom, Callista Codd, played by Deborah Mooney, pays an unexpected visit and does a little snooping of her own.
Oh, sorry, I read about this. I just did a little bit of reading. Do you want me to tell you the thing about Callista Codd?
What do you mean, the thing?
She's white, so we learned that Emerson is mixed race.
Oh, cool.
Neat. Yeah, man, those sound really fun. They sound like they're getting more into the like mystery big picture stuff, which is exciting.
Yeah.
Let's take it to the plug zone, Magellan.
Let's do it.
You can, of course, follow Chats on Twitter by following it at ChatsPod. That is ChatsPod. You can also email us at chatspod@gmail.com if you want to send us feedback and comments, which we'll read on the show. And if you like our show and you want to support us and you want to help us keep doing chats, please consider visiting us at patreon.com/chatspod and becoming a patron for our podcast. If you back us over there at $2 or more, you're going to be receiving regular episodes of a special new show that we're doing called Commentary Chats.
Yes.
We're going to be getting back into watching movies, and we're going to do live commentaries of them, and it's a ton of fun. We just put out our first episode of Commentary Chats. We watched One Piece Film Gold together, and it was a ton of fun, and if you back us, like I said, you can get that episode and any future episodes of the show.
Heck yeah.
So if you've ever wanted to watch a movie with us in your ear, then, you know, hit it up.
Do it. It's a good time.
Many thanks to both our patrons, Kat and Philip. You make this thing happen. Make the dream come true. Keep the Republic alive. Defeat the First Order. Star Wars now in theaters. Magellan, where can people find you on the online?
They can find me online on Twitter at JustAFluke. That's JustAFluke. They can also listen to another show with my voice called Adulthood at adulthood.simplecast.fm. Alan, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter, currently inactively, at Alan Ibrahim. That's AlenIbrahim. And you can listen to me on two other podcasts. One is Fireside Friends, which is found at firesidefriends.net. That's where my friends Ryan, Katie, and I talk about pop culture once a month. And we have a good time, and we do shared experiences, and it's lovely. You can also listen to me on The Garnet Wager, where my friend Six and I watch the Korean game show The Genius, and we play a game called Fantasy Genius, which is like Fantasy The Bachelor or Fantasy Football, but for a Korean game show, which is really fun and smart and good. And you can check that out at scanlinemedia.com. That's what I got, boy.
Sweet.
Thank you so much, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Daisy Chats. Keep on living.